Welcome to Colors of the Dark. It has been a wild and crazy week, so we're recording this a little later than usual. Elric Kane, how you feeling? You've been under the weather.
I got sick from the film The Jar.
I
Put that on the box
am
first.
so excited that I was sitting next to you the whole time and somehow did not get the plague, but still got all the residual effects of the jar.
The assumption is that Billy Ray Bruton gave me a sickness. Even if he wasn't sick, it was Billy Ray Bruton who made me sick. Billy Ray Bruton of Antenna Releasing. So direct all emails to Billy Ray Bruton at Antenna Releasing. I hope he hears this.
I am going to say that it was the movie itself, that
I think it
it was
was.
whatever that weird little pickled punk that was like
Pickled punk, yeah.
lurking inside the
Like it
jar.
looks like a little goblin in a pickled
Yeah,
bar, you know?
in like a little, formaldehyde jar, that is what its essence went through the screen and infused itself into you. Did you have any hallucinogenic trips like the jar?
I know, but I'll say, like, if me and Brian were technically hosting it and stuff, but like, even having seen it and wanting to play it still doesn't prepare me for watching it again. It's one of those movies, as an indie film that was kind of a lost indie film that's, obviously gotten this great restoration. It's still completely baffling, and I can't stop wanting to know more about it because it's just so strange. And I like it a lot, but I also, even watching it then, I was like, I still don't have my hands around it. It's a
No,
very strange movie.
so I'm gonna back up a bit and
Oh.
say, so what we're talking about here is Elric and Brian Sowers of Pure Cinema Podcast hosted a screening of the 1987 question
Something
mark, I
like that,
forget,
yeah.
something like that, film The Jar, which if you just Google The Jar 1987, you're gonna see this box cover that if you are in any way Gen X millennial, you're immediately going to go, oh, I remember that box cover. But a lot of us didn't rent it. And a lot of the folks that did got so kind of put off by it that they didn't finish it. And so it didn't get a lot of play. But Elric and Brian had rediscovered it along with Billy Ray Bruton and been kind of like, hey, this is weird and trippy. Now, I was one of those people where I could have sworn I had rented it. Like, surely I did. I must have. I remember that box cover so vividly. Of course, I must have rented it. There's no fucking way I ever saw this thing because I would have remembered the weirdness that was this movie. It's like a dream logic the whole time. Like, there
Yeah, the whole
is
thing. It
no,
never is normal.
it's never normal. Yeah.
It's a mixture of like amateur. There's moments where you're like, this is kind of amateur. Other moments where you're like, wait, this feels like Mario Bava in
Yeah.
terms of color. And then I don't want to ruin it for people, but towards the end, there's this big moment that doesn't feel like it should be in the same movie. And you're like, whoa, what the hell am I watching? Like a 1980s TV series or something. Suddenly, it's just very unusual. So yeah, the very brief history we've talked about on Deep Cuts a long time ago, but the brief history was that these guys who were very young in their early 20s, who were inspired by Argento and Cronenberg and all these great things, made this movie. But the distribution company, they shot in CinemaScope, and the distribution company cut the edges off the frame, made it box, made it looks like a shot through water. They did not do a good restoration when they put it out on VHS. They called a movie that was meant to be called Charon was suddenly called The Jar. So basically, they took the only element that looks like a horror film, which is like the little creature in a jar, and made that the center point. And so if you go in expecting that movie, there's pretty much nothing but disappointment. But if you go in open, suddenly you're watching this very ambitiously strange movie. And my thing I told everyone when we left, it felt like, Mark Borchardt from American Movie, the documentary. It feels like the movie he was always trying to make. It has that feeling like if he had made a feature, this could have been where its ambition, but also like not having quite the tools to pull off some of the things you're trying to aim for on an indie level, you know?
Yeah, the only plot that I can give from this is that there's a guy who gets into an automobile accident. According to IMDb, he is a school teacher. I
Oh,
definitely
didn't get
did
that.
not pick up
No.
that at all, even when his
Except
boss
that he has a
shows up.
beard.
Yeah, I did not pick up any of that. But he gets into a car accident with an elderly man who's carrying this giant bag. And the guy is like, I don't want to go to a hospital. He's like clearly injured. And so he's like you do. Well, I'll take you back to my apartment and clean you up a bit. If you get into an accident with somebody, don't take them back to your apartment. But the guy's carrying this giant sack and he's pretty messed up. So our character Paul takes him back to his apartment, tries to just let him sleep it off. He gets up the next morning. The guy that he hit with the car is gone. And what he has left behind is that big giant bag he was carrying, which inside contains what looks like an oversized pickle jar with a little demon thing kind of floating in it. And at the time, he's just like, what the fuck is this? And throws it out, but it starts invading his psyche. and giving him nightmares, and it keeps reappearing in his life, and that's where the plot stops. So,
And then
and it
there's
just
a
gets
series of
weird.
strange, yes, like he's being almost slowly possessed, or his dreams are being taken over, and but the actual style is the reason to watch the movie. I think it's
Oh,
just got
yeah.
these, but I think the advantage of watching at home is that we watched this amazing. This is a Terrorvision restoration, and we got to watch this amazing, like one of my favorite documentaries in a while, because it's just about this movie and the director talking about why they did the things they did, and it really helped at the time make the movie seem even more impressive. I'm sure a lot of people left the screening going like, what did I just encounter? So go home, buy the jar, watch the documentary.
I don't know if it'll be as good without the corned beef and pickles that we had at
Oh, yeah, we had
Cantor's right
pickles. Yeah.
beforehand, but you can try. You can
Yeah.
try. That was
Always worth a
definitely
shot.
good.
Yeah.
Okay, so last night I watched the fourth, speaking of weird and trippy, I watched the new episode of Widow's Bay, the fourth episode of Widow's Bay. Now, let me just say the third and fourth episode of this show have just cemented that this is like the greatest show I have seen in so long.
This is the best thing going right now this
It's
year.
just,
People, if you're
it's
not watching it
amazing.
yet, if me
Holy
and
shit.
Becca are in agreement that this is the best thing out there, it is the tonally perfect show. And
Oh my
it's like
gosh, yeah.
horror comedy in the way that the reason I don't tend to gravitate towards horror comedy is because I don't usually buy it. I usually think the tone is off, and I don't believe you can really be equally horror, scary, and funny. This is the most perfect tonal blend, and I love the lead actor in the fourth episode. He is, I would give the Emmy for that performance. I just thought it
He's
was so
so good. Oh,
funny.
God, no, the drug
So
dealer
good.
was everything.
That was great.
But the third episode, because I had just watched that one recently, was so good because it's all very Wicker Man and folk art. And I love how each episode is becoming kind of its own standalone, but they still connect. And in some cases, they're all happening at the same time. So you're seeing instances of it in some episode. And then in the next episode, we find out what she meant when she said, like, this thing was crazy, or why she was wet. Like, they're all interconnected. The fourth episode, it's all about mushrooms. That's all you need to know. But it was just so disjointed and nonlinear, but so smart in how it was giving information, even though that our narrator was under the influence the whole time, like how we were getting information from him. It was just so clever.
I
So
have a friend who's waiting to get his Apple back before watching it all at once. But I've got to say, as much as it leaves me wanting more every time, I think it really enhances how good the show is by not getting it all at once, because I would watch this in one night if it
Yes.
was all out. But I don't think that's the best way. I think there's something really strong about these, like, perfectly, they're only like 25 minutes, each
Yeah,
episode. And
episodes.
I mean, maybe two a week would be perfect, but I think its power and why it's gonna, it's gaining a lot of cult status while it's still on. So it's beyond cult. It's just gonna become popular is because of that. Whereas if it was released all on, maybe it's easier to dismiss it quickly and not be as interested. And I think this is one of the things about release strategy people need to go back and look at for all things, because I do think that this is gonna end up being very popular by the end of its first season. People are going to have time to catch up to it, because of people like us. It's not just us. I am starting to see pop-ups everywhere of people I trust talking about this, and it's exciting because it's so good.
You know, there is something to that because it was always this idea of an audience has to grow. And so, like, it was very much like if you just put eight episodes of the X-Files on back to back in the 90s, would that have had the same success of growing it so that everybody is, you know, talking about it, that it becomes that water cooler discussion each week? There is something about that because the shows that I find that get dumped on Netflix that we're all super excited about for like a really short time period of like, oh my God, I watched them all in 2 days. They burn out real quick. Like everybody's talking about them. It's the hot thing for a week and then it's done. And you hope that you're getting more. And there are certain shows that I like to watch like that, like From. That's one where I save until the entire season's almost done. I watch the first episode of the new season. I will save the rest of it until the season is almost done, and then I'll rejoin MGM, Epix, wherever it is now, to watch all of them. But with this one, how it's being delayed is honestly one of the best parts.
A perfect example, I believe, this year is Something Bad Is Going to Happen. I watched it all in 2 days, two nights, and I really liked that I could watch it that way, but I don't hear people talking about
I
that.
have not spoken about it since the day we finished watching that last
I'm
episode.
telling you right now, that show had all the right hallmarks to end each episode with a real hook and get you really invested in who the people are. I think people would still be talking about it if each week they were waiting for the next part of the mystery. And I think if that lasts 8 to 10 weeks, I really think, and so I think that's, I think what we're getting to now is different release structures for different types of things, but because Netflix has their way and it's here it is, all is, and then you watch and it's kind of forgotten, which is a shame because there's a lot of artistry in there. But anyway, yes, that is definitely the show to hunt down. You will not be disappointed.
Well, let me just start by saying that The Sheep Detectives was my best by far.
You're not allowed to talk about Sheep Detectives here.
It's
There's no
one of the
horror in
best
that.
things I've seen.
Tried to
No, it was
locate a horror
so good.
angle.
No, you have to go
Not with
see it.
the horror angle.
It
No, I
was so
can't.
good. Okay, fine,
No.
fine. Then I'm gonna
No.
go on. I'm gonna keep going weird.
Hugh Jackman completionists can go
It
there.
was
I
so
did hear it
good.
was good. I've
It
heard it's
was
good.
really good. But that said, I'm just gonna stay with the weird stuff. Let's talk about Buffet Infinity. This is one
Wait, we
that.
should go back. We have to talk about Obsession first. I
Okay,
can't. I'm
fine.
not
Talk
going to the
about
obscure one.
Obsession. Go ahead.
I
I
can't
haven't
go at
seen
this
this
obscure.
one. So
Okay.
keep you go Obsession.
Okay, I'll do it without being spoilers. What I will say, and I don't over superlatives. And some people will love this film, some people won't like it. But I truly believe this. This is being said from the real place in my heart. I believe this is the most significant horror film we've had really since Get Out. And I think Hereditary and when Hereditary came out and The Witch, that would be the other markers. I think this is one of those big markers in horror releases. A, because it's a brilliant movie. And of its moment, completely of its moment. But why I say like it's a game changer in a lot of ways, in the same way Get Out is I just think a kind of voice like very much like Jordan Peele. This is a sketch comedian performer who had a YouTube channel. But the big shift is this is the first real massive breakthrough of, and the floodgates have started to open that we've seen from that real taking someone from the YouTube space, even though we've had a couple really great films from the Felipe brothers and stuff like
We
that.
had
But
like
this is.
Iron Lung.
Iron Lung made a lot of money. This is a different level of all of those. This is like so well. This is so about a current person, kind of person. The guy in this movie, like everyone's only going to be talking about the performance of Indy Neverett, and she is. It is my favorite horror performance in probably a decade, maybe longer. I love it. Everything she does in this movie is absolutely brilliant. A person I'd never heard of before this movie, and now she's going to be an icon, which is just amazing. This is the amazing thing about horror. But these are all unknown people outside of a YouTube space making a movie for 700 grand that has made 21,000 times its budget in the first 3 days. If that isn't a story in itself, coming from YouTube, then this is what keeps horror as the most exciting genre because there's always new voices popping up. There's always a new way to do it. And there's always some sort of financial insanity that sometimes can happen. Every few years, we have examples of this. So to me, there's a lot of things, but I do think it's a real signpost of that. But the guy in it, Michael Johnston, who's playing this character, I haven't hated a character the way I hated him. And he's the lead character. I haven't felt that way about a character in a long time, but that's really interesting because they also do it in a way that's quite subtle. Usually, when you have like a guy who does something bad or an asshole type character, they're just that very one note type of asshole. This is like a very real person with different layers, could be seen as the nice guy, could be seen. But this movie just skewers this type of character in a way that I don't think, and it's such a modern character. I thought it was brilliant. But it's also just the horror of it and the intensity and the weird dark humor. I was laughing a lot. People in where I live in Santa Clarita do not. I've never heard this ever at a movie outside of maybe Minecraft. When the movie ended, I saw it with my friend Star, and there weren't many people there. It was like 9:30 on Friday night. When the movie ended, people started clapping, and I turned to him and went, "Have you ever heard that here? Where we live, like it's one thing when you're in Hollywood,
I was going to say they
like,
clapped at the end of Sheep Detective.
yeah. Well, in Burbank, I'm sure you get a lot more industry, but out here, I don't think I've ever heard people call. And it wasn't like everyone, but it was just like, oh, that sense of whoa, you guys just went there in a movie all the way, and it just impressed the fuck out of me. And there's a part of you when you're getting a bit older, but you still want to make movies where you're like, you could take this as such a threat because this is a 25-year-old. But I'm like, no, I feel the opposite. This is a reminder of the excitement you can get from reinventing and your own ideas too, and the way you approach material and trying to be really contemporary about things and jump into it. So anyway, I don't want to overdo it because that's already overdoing it. But I really do think it's a bit of a it's going to be a big marker post for horror, whether people like the movie or not, just on an industry level. But I also just thought it was a great movie. I'm very glad he didn't act in it as the lead, Trey Burke. Oh, not because he's not good; he's good. But I think that would have ruined the type of character that you needed at the center of this movie. And I think he's the star of his next one that's already in the can. We Hunt Ghosts or something. We Are Ghosts or whatever. Not Ghosts or something. It's already in the can for Blumhouse. So that's the next one by him, which is more of a comedy. But this has got black humor, very dark, but not. I would not call it a comedy. But yes, I'll be curious to see what you think. I think you once you're in it, once it gets going, it goes pretty crazy. And it's, a monkey paw movie, but it's a monkey paw movie like you haven't quite seen before,
Yeah,
which
I
I
got the
thought.
gist of it. So I
Yeah.
do love a good Monkey Paw movie. So
And it goes
yeah,
dark.
I'm hoping to see it this weekend because if I wait till next weekend, then I'm butting up against Backrooms and I have to go see Backrooms
A
because my
lot of
kids
stuff
will
coming.
like die if they don't go see that one. So yeah, we have to go see that one. But okay. Now I'm gonna, you know what?
Yes,
I'm
take
not
us
gonna
to
go.
where?
I'm not
Oh,
gonna
no,
go
okay.
Buffet
Hold out. All
Infinity
right,
yet.
hold
You know
back.
where I'm gonna go? Because
No.
it's another kind of Monkey Paw movie. I'm gonna take us to If Wishes Could Kill,
Oh,
which
are you
is
serious?
not a movie. It's an 8-episode series on Netflix. And this is South Korean, brand new to Netflix. And I did not even know this existed in true Netflix fashion until one of our listeners messaged me on Instagram and was like, "Hey, everybody's talking about Widow's Bay. Nobody is talking about If Wishes Could Kill on Netflix." And so I was like, "Okay." It's got really high reviews on Letterboxd. I was like, "I'm going in." It's good. I had a lot of fun with this. I am on the sixth episode and it definitely goes there. And this is one that you could binge the whole thing if I had that type of time in my life. But yeah, because all 8 episodes are available now. But it is about a group of teens in South Korea and they're not annoying. That's again, it goes back to that obsession. Like it's not, they're not one note. It's not, this is the hot girl and that's the evil guy. They all feel rounded teens, still going through teen stuff in their high school. One of them discovers this phone app, this like completely underground phone app called Garigo, which you open it up, you open up the camera element, and you record a video of yourself making a wish. And then you send it off to the app. And then he discovers that it's come true. And the very first thing that he wishes for is for 100 on a math test. And he gets it. And everybody is like, "Oh my God, you're cheating. They're going to turn you in." And he's like, no. Let me show you how this happened." And he shows his friends the app and he sends it all to them. And so they start playing around with it. And they start with really stupid stuff. But the moment that your wish comes true, the moment that he finds out that he gets an A on that math test, a countdown starts on the app, and he realizes that something is going to happen in like 48 hours. And so it's this continuous countdown that's reminding you that, you have 12 hours left, and he doesn't know what's coming. And what it is, and they do show it in the cold open, is at the end of the countdown, the app forces you to kill yourself in some capacity. And so it gets real brutal, real quick. So it is a monkey paw. It's kind of like, what is the thing that you would wish for at all costs? And when kids are like throwing it away on dumb stuff. And then where it gets really high school is it focuses a lot on cyberbullying, like people who have been bullying other people. So like, I wish so and so would die, but you're dying by it, by your own hand with it. And it gets a lot into that, kind of the consequences that come days later. So it feels like a lot of elements that we have seen before. We have seen haunted apps. We have seen, kind of this wish fulfillment gone horribly wrong type stuff. But somehow in this, it's really working well together. And I think a lot of it is the characters that I actually liked them. So when I was seeing it all go horribly wrong, it felt terrible. So yeah, it was fun. I enjoyed it. I say fun. It was interesting and really dark because it does deal. I mean, I will use all the suicide trigger warnings for this one because it's literally the end game of the app. So there is a lot of that in there. But it is has a lot to say about cyberbullying and kind of the outcomes of it within that. But yeah, this is on Netflix now and definitely worth your time. So if Wishes Could Kill, I would be surprised if somebody has not already said, "Hey, let's remake this." Like it
Was
just feels like there should be an American remake on the way.
that South Korea, did you say?
South
Okay.
Korea.
So nearby, Japan. This is one of my favorite things I've seen this year as well. This was given to me by a fest person. It's called Kinki, Kinki, but it's actually the title. You can also search it. Is called About a Place in the Kinki Region. So it's not about being kinky. It's a place. This is, had I known who directed it, it would have made a lot more sense. But this movie's really interesting. It is directed by Koji Shirayashi, and look him up, and he is the director of Narai, The Curse.
Oh, that one's great.
This is I think this is on the level. This is really crazy. So there, it opens with all these people's phones and all the different Reddits and all the different creepypastas, and they're all, all these different stories and creepy Japanese stories in modern media. And then it cuts to a magazine that does investigative pieces of supernatural kinds of stories, partially debunking, but partially also doing them. There's a young guy talking to his boss who's working on a big story in the basement. And then he suddenly goes missing, and he's got all the work that he's been working on, and suddenly something creepy happens. And this is a mixture between like a J-horror and a creepy found footage. It's got more of a merger of the two, so it's not just like Norai, which is just in the found footage mode only. This is like a lot of different stories. We get like five or so different sub stories that they are tracing, trying to draw together, and you get the movie. So, funnily enough, quite a lot like, in a way, some of the movies being made in the book that we'll be talking about with Michael Wehunt later in this episode, in his book. But they all start to come together. This guy gets this other woman, who was kind of his mentor, to come help him investigate the disappearance of this guy and maybe finish the article that he'd been working on. And it comes to like there's this story from the woods where some teens staying in a place heard somebody kind of making creepy sounds, like saying, come here, come here into the woods, kind of creepy messaging. They start tracing it, and then there's this whole folklore around it that is really twisty and turny. And by the end of this movie, it is beyond some real creepy images. There's a thing with its head. Like, imagine your head going all the way back to the back part of your back, and that's how you walk around. There's an image of a creature, of like a ghost like that, that's really creepy at one point, but it's building up towards a big, crazy looking Lovecraftian Japanese mythic thing. And so I was like, this is like, and I have never heard of this movie. Like, literally, if it wasn't handed to me, I don't think it's out yet. It's been on the festival since 2025, middle of the year. So I think it must be coming close to being out here. But I just wanted to put it on people's radar because no one's put it on mine particularly yet. And it's really cool if that's your jam. I haven't seen a great, like The Wailing and movies like that. I feel like it's in all of those really strong categories. So
Ooh, send me the link. I want to see this one.
yeah, this is called About a Place in the Kinky Region.
Okay, now I'm going to get weird. Let's
Yeah.
go to Buffet Infinity.
Okay.
This is a new one that has just released from the fine folks at Yellow Veil. And I had an absolute blast with this. This is one that somebody had messaged me about and given me a heads up and said, oh my God, you are absolutely going to love how absurdist this is. It is a horror story told through local commercials. The whole thing is set up as if we are watching a local network, but all we're watching is the commercials on it. So specifically, it's in Alberta. So it's the Westridge County in Alberta. And it starts with two restaurants that are kind of fighting back and forth for dominance within this little strip mall area. Buffet Infinity, which is a buffet with all these different types of food, and then this little sandwich shop that's owned by a woman. And the two of them are kind of lobbing insults back and forth. And then there's other shops in the shopping center. There's like a pet place, and then there's also an electronics store. And then we're also going back and forth with a pawn shop. There's a car dealership and a couple other local places, restaurants and places like that. And there's a lawyer as well. So we're seeing all these local commercials. But what we begin to kind of cleave out through these commercials is that the main action is taking place at this strip mall where the sandwich shop and Buffet Infinity are. There is a sinkhole that has developed, and it's worked in so subtly where at the end of the episodes, they'll be like, please park on the backside, sinkhole on the front. And, it'll go by really quick, and you just realize that there is something there that is affecting people. And then you'll hear people talking about weird sounds coming out. And then you'll start seeing news footage of people gone missing, that there's people going missing. But most of what we're seeing is still these restaurant ads going back and forth. This gets really somehow, there's a cult that comes into it. We're seeing commercials for a church that gets a little culty, that they seem to realize that something's happening in the town. This gets Lovecraftian apocalyptic. And I don't want to say a lot more than that because I don't want to kind of ruin the joy of the developments as they come while you're watching it. But this was a blast for me. This is exactly the type of thing that I love, where it's experimental, it's weird. It's the whole concept of can we do an entire horror film just through local TV ads? And I love that somebody came up with that absurdist concept and ran with it.
And it's definitely more comedy. Like, it has a horror element for sure, but it's definitely the guy as a comedian who made it, and there is a comedy level to all of it in that way. I think it's really interesting. I liked it, and I knew you would love it. But the funny thing, I've been poisoned because I show it every year. I think one of the greatest short films of the last like 20 years is Great Choice,
I
and that's
show it
what this
every
is.
year too. I
And I
show it
just,
every year
but
to
it
my
kind of broke my
students.
heart a little bit because I was like, well, I know that guy's probably out there trying to make a feature out of Great Choice, and the tone is so similar.
It
These
is.
are no, I'm not saying that Buffet Infinity guy might never, very well, never seen this, but the thing of using a commercial and the repetition of it. So for me, it was just hard because I've already seen something that I love that's doing this. But I did have fun with it. But Great Choice, if you have, it's hard to see,
It's
unfortunately, because
hard
there's
to
a whole,
see. I have a direct link that he sent me eons ago when I said I want to show it to my classes, like an example of experimental filmmaking. It's hard to find. But
Well,
yeah,
look at
that's
you.
a.
I have a ripped off one with Russian subtitles that I ripped off the internet a while ago that I use, but
I
still.
just emailed the filmmaker and, sent him my syllabus.
It's more,
He
it's most
was
subversive
nice.
with Russian subtitles. Red Lobster, great choice. But this is, we'll probably never see that feature. So this might be as close as you'll ever get to that
I
vibe.
hope we do. But this is really good in the
But it's
meantime.
fun, yeah. I saw one that would kind of double with it kind of well because it's about a lot of it's about eating. My favorite parts of Buffet Infinity is when the Buffet Infinity one would make fun of the sauce the other place uses in their sandwich. It's a
The secret
family secret,
sauce.
and they're always like, "And we also have a sauce. Not that we make it a big deal. Like, it, why should it be the biggest part of a commercial? It's just nothing. It's sauce." I watched one called Saccharin, which is coming to it is about to come to Shudder soon. But this is Natalie Erica James, who made The Relic and Apartment 47A, I believe. I put her in my highest stock in terms of directors. If you ask me, like, who's going to make a great movie someday of like upcoming directors, she's somebody I would put it. I just think Relic is really, really special and really well
Oh,
made.
yeah.
Apartment 47A is really well made, but a little redundant.
It
And
feels very studio.
like, you
It
already know
feels,
where it's going because
you
of what
can
it's,
feel the notes behind it.
Well, and you see, mostly I think it's redundant because I've seen Rosemary's Baby. So unless it's going to be a whole new spin on the side of that story, it had its moments. But in Saccharin, I feel so. There's a thing I don't do that great with movies where the theme is the thing you're just hitting with every shot. And usually, to me, a good theme is like there, but you're telling the story, and then the theme is something that pops up as it needs to, or just, inevitably. And sometimes I'll see features, a lot of them actually, where the theme is, it feels more like short films, where that is the theme, the short film is the theme. So this is about a medical student who's very lovelorn. She considers herself overweight. She's got a crush on the really good, in shape woman who runs the gym instruction kind of thing. And so she wants to be like her. She's, I wouldn't say she has an issue, but it's her perspective. And so she runs into an old friend at a nightclub. She works in a training to be a doctor, with cadavers and stuff. And she runs into an old friend who used to be heavy in high school, and she doesn't even recognize her, who now is this hottie in a nightclub. And the girl goes, "Oh yeah, you should take these pills. It's called Gray." And she's like, "Oh, what is Gray?" And she's like, "I don't know, but and within days of taking, I started losing all this weight." And she takes one in the nightclub, and then has a couple weird experiences. And then, because she's a medical student, she does a forensic test on the pill and discovers that inside the pill capsule is the ash, and she realizes it's human ashes. So somebody making this thing has been using human ashes as a weight loss product. So she's like, "Well, I work here. I can make my own." So she uses that. There's a Big Bertha is a cadaver that they are working on at the moment, her and her friends. She crack after hours cracks off the ribs, basically burns it to a crisp, and then starts putting it into pills, and then takes them. Now already I'm watching this going, "I don't know, man. You could tell me anything would work, but I am not putting human cadaver inside myself. Like, if it happened accidentally, I might have bought it, but I was like, I am not. You're already stopping me from starting." But she goes down that, and she starts to lose weight. But more importantly, this is the element that really does work in this movie. It's a very good looking movie, really stylish, shot by the DP of Smile. So I like that element of it. But she starts to see in reflective surfaces that are, not just like glass, but like convex, kind of like the metal kettle or the handle of a door, that kind of stuff. You start to see a ghost of the person who you've been swallowing their bones, and she starts. And Bertha seems to be getting bigger and more powerful as she's getting skinnier. And so it's got some interesting stuff, but it is really like lots of scenes of people eating a lot. It's 120 minutes, where it doesn't really. It feels like if you got this down to 90 and you didn't hit it quite as much on the nose. I think it would work a lot better, but it's very, I mean, it's pretty overt, but it's got a lot of stuff in it that's also kind of disturbing and intense and pretty crazy. So I think a lot of people will really dig this movie. I just sometimes, I'm a little about story. Sometimes it feels a little spoon-fed in that way, but and maybe that's the running time. But interesting concept, a weight loss drug that's made of human ashes. Great concept.
Ooh.
Yeah, and then you start seeing the ghost. So that's Saccharin, and I know it's coming within the next couple of weeks.
Okay, that I have that already on my watch list. That does sound quite good. And I love Relics so much.
Yeah,
So
Relic's good.
I'm in regardless, even with 120 minute runtime. Okay, let's quickly talk about Devil in Silver, just because this was the new one from The Terror on AMC. And so The Terror, I've liked their prior two iterations. They did the absolutely amazing one, based on a true story about the ship stuck in the ice and they couldn't move. And that was based on the true story. That's where the name The Terror comes from. It was actually the name of one of the ships. And then the second season they did, oh gosh, I can't remember it, but I believe
It was a Japanese
it's a
story.
Japanese
I haven't
story.
seen that one yet.
I liked it when I watched it and I can't remember what it was, but the cast was really good and it had creepy moments to it. It wasn't all horror. It was definitely kind of more unnerving and dramatic, but I liked it, what I saw of it. Okay, so this one, new season, and again, these reboot themselves every season with a whole new story. This is based off a book called Devil in Silver, which I admittedly have not read, and it is all set, for the most part, in an insane asylum. For this, our protagonist is a hot-headed guy trying to get his life together with some girl and her daughter, and
He's into metal and
he's
moving
into metal.
trash.
That's kind of all we get is that he's into metal and odd jobs. And then one day he punches her ex-husband, who's kind of pushing her around. The cops show up out of nowhere, haul him off to an insane asylum because they say that they have an arrangement with the insane asylum. And then he is stuck there and can't get out for some reason. And you can already tell by how I'm describing this plot that there's some big holes that are missing from it, in my opinion. But he's now in an insane asylum. That's kind of where we get to the meat of this. He is now stuck in an insane asylum. He cannot get out, and he is totally sane and discovers that there is some type of more supernatural horror that's happening at the insane asylum. There's something there that's haunting people.
There's a guy, the guy whose room he took over in bed the night, the cold open, I guess, is that guy has died and he's like almost frozen and there's blood all over the
Like
bed
ripped
and
his head off, ripped his own
his
face
hand, his
off.
fingers are all like mangly in the way they're frozen. So we don't know what did it, but something in the slats above, or something. But yeah, look, Karen Kusama did the first two episodes. They're well directed and everything. Dan Stevens, the star, so that's why I'm there. I'm going to stick with it. It's based on a novel by Victor Laval. I wasn't grabbed by the first two. I was like, okay, I'm curious. Okay. And I'm going to watch a third. And hopefully, I'm like interested in parts, but other parts felt, like you said, it's like things will happen too fast at times.
There's parts that are underbaked, and then there's other parts where it felt like there was probably a whole like chapter or two on that in the book, and it's just given an explainer and not a really good one. Like why the cops just suddenly appear back at the insane asylum out of nowhere.
Well, and that's the other problem. It's like because it's not a, it probably isn't an insane asylum, right? Like just because it's set now, it's probably in they're calling it like this clinic where you could just get observed for like 3 days and then you're fine. But clearly, there's some loophole that's keeping these people stuck there because their behavior is not ticking the box. It doesn't feel. I think if this was set in 1958 or 1960, we would have less of a problem. But it does feel a little like, really? Can we do this Kafkaesque thing in the modern? Maybe I'm wrong because I don't know that thing, but. I am going to stick with it. Let's check in a couple weeks and see if it picks up because there was enough there to keep me curious.
I did the first two episodes, and I gotta say, I found myself pulled into the horror elements of the asylum, pulled back out by some of the little just minutia of just general storytelling that I was kind of like, but wait, how does that work? And it would just rip me back out real
It
quickly.
feels a little bit more American Horror Story than it does the original Terror. Because ooh, there's that doctor for the haunted doctor is probably dead from the. It's like that feels more an American Horror Story kind of thing. But anyway, we'll
Let's
come
see
back.
where it goes.
One quick one, I won't go into it, but just for you, this is a big deal. Chestnut Man season two has
I know.
dropped.
I've heard it's really good.
It's just as good as the first, but it is a totally di it's a bummer because the name Chestnut Man is obviously about that first case. It's the same two cops. There's been a few years in between, and he for a reason has to come back to town. They hint that they were a couple for a while when we weren't watching and split up, and now he's coming back and it's caused some friction. It's six episodes. It's on Netflix. This is one of the best shows going. Like the first season was like just total banger. This is a new one. It's called the subtitle of this one is Hide and Seek, I believe, and it is about it's basically more of a stalking story where somebody will be stalking you, sending you videos of yourself doing things for months, and then one day you'll get one saying you want to play hide and seek, and they will literally come inside your house and film you from behind and be like, found you, send you a text, and then abduct you or kill you. And so
Oof.
it gets, but it has a really good backstory at the start that shows you something that happened like 20 years earlier, kind of like the first one. A lot of similarities, first one. It does something I've don't think I've seen done in a TV show very often, and it was very surprising. Even more so than the first season, that's all I'll say. Absolutely recommend it. I can't say any more about it. And then last thing I have to plug, because a good buddy of ours had a new movie that I just got to see in time because our show was delayed. It came out on Tuesday night on streaming called Blood and Rust. And this is our buddy, and he's been in one of your movies, Mark Kelly,
Aw, love
as the
Mark Kelly.
lead in a movie as a vampire hunter.
Ooh.
This is very much like a straight to video 1980s. If this was the 80s, this would have made total sense. This is like a kind of ambitious, set in Ohio, Rust Belt small town. Opens with this younger black guy who works at his dad's diner at night, and it's a real drag for him. And then cut to his dad, who's like kicking it back, and these like weird vampires, kind of they wear kind of like hooded cloaks, and they're kind of they feel like junkies basically the way they treat them, and they all invade his house and kill him. And at the funeral, Mark Kelly kicks in the door at the funeral, kind of walks in, and you don't know what he is, but some loner with a truck. And he talks to the guy afterwards and saves his ass from this vampire attack and says, basically, I lost my family. I've been tracking these things from town to town. I'll help you. I'll help you out with this. And the two of them then get involved in this, like, but it's done in a way it's interesting. Like they're circling this homeless camp. The vampires are obviously taking advantage of sewers and stuff. So it's quite ambitious, even though you can tell it's a low budget indie. So parts of it the seams show, but in a way that I found quite charming. And their chemistry on screen is quite fun. I thought it was really fun, and it was fun. I'm totally biased because of Mark Kelly, but I was happy to see him getting a lead in something like this. Ross
Yeah.
Partridge is the bad guy, the big bad vampire, and Ross Partridge is also from the same world Mark Kelly, which is early Duplass movies. He Ross Partridge is the lead in Baghead by the Duplass, and Mark
Oh.
Kelly is the lead in Dodecadecathlon by the Duplass brothers. So yeah, anyway, Blood and Rust, that one's out right now, and it's fun.
And huge congrats to Mike Mendez on
Oh, yeah.
Cannes. We will be getting you on
Guernsey,
once,
nothing
yeah,
goes
for
horror but Bruce
nothing
Dern.
with her, but yeah, Bruce Dern, we'll get him on later when it's coming out. So, okay, let's get into our history or factoid segment. Where are you at
I'll
today?
do mine because it's super quick and it ties to what we were just talking. So, this May, I just have not seen anything like this in a long time. This May, Hokum, which was my favorite movie of the year, a week later, Obsession comes out. I'm like, that's my favorite movie of the year. This left in just May, we have this week, Passenger, which looks like an absolute banger. And then we close the month out with Backrooms. That's not to mention probably some interesting stuff on streaming and things like that. But that's four, I would say, I don't know the quality of the other two yet, but I'm guessing four very high quality and very next gen movies coming out at once. And so it made me think, I was like, I cannot remember a single month like this. So I went back and thought, well, I remember how I felt when Blair Witch came out in Sixth Sense. I remember that being like a big deal. So I looked that up. It turns out it was actually a month apart. So I'm not including that. So I was like, what is the greatest month ever of horror releases? And so we have, so I think May is in the running for the last like 20 years, I'd say. It's like, this is going to be one of those, wow, why are they all dropping in May? I have no idea. But okay, so my close runner up, July 1986, this is a biggie. On July the 2nd in 1986, Big Little Trouble in Little China and Psycho 3 released. On the 18th, Aliens and Vamp are released. And on the 25th, Maximum Overdrive and our beloved Australian exploitation film, Fair Game, which is a great film. So those are all coming out in July 1986. Good month. May 1980 had The Shining and Friday 13th on the same date.
Oh,
They
that's
also
a
had
big one.
sci-fi. I'm also including some sci-fi: Empire Strikes Back and Humanoids from the Deep. So that's that. And I know when we bring these titles up, you're like, oh yeah, of course. But it's like to have two things coming out within days of each other that are still being discussed for the next 40 years. You're like,
And
okay, that
that's
is kind of
three.
crazy.
That's Empire, Friday the 13th, and
And
The
Friday
Shining
13th,
all in the same day.
Empire was probably a couple weeks later, but it's all in May 1980. But the winner, and it wasn't up for debate. Everyone online would, there's Reddits on this particular date. So I looked at a lot of others. There's some good 70s ones, but nothing amazing. Usually they're about 2 or 3 months apart, some of the big ones. This is the crazy one, and people probably know where I'm going. June 1982, June 4th, the same day, Poltergeist and E.T. are released on the same day. Which is just bizarre, especially given that Spielberg's involved in both. June 25th, The Thing and Blade Runner on the same day.
Wow.
And then also, which I consider horror personally, because you'll see where I'm going with this, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan scared me more than most horror films
It's
did
got
when I was.
the
It
ear creature in it,
terrified me.
right?
Yes. I started on a plane when I was whatever age I was, five, six, whatever, and it scared the shit out of me. And just as a low-hanging fruit horror film, Girls' Night Out with the crazy bear also came out the same day as Star Trek. So that's Poltergeist, E.T., The Thing, Blade Runner, and Star Trek II in June of 1982. I'm like, okay, well, that's powerful shit, especially if you include sci-fi. So golden period. I am not complaining. I'm really happy to have had a month. I don't think July is going to be, and June are going to be, the summer is going to probably be leaner for us, but I'm glad we're on air while these four movies are all coming out. It's exciting stuff.
Wow. Okay, well, my history fact has nothing to do with anything except that there was a new Silent Hill movie, which I did not enjoy. I finally saw it and
You
it
saw it. I
was
didn't see it. Okay. All
play
right.
the
We can
video
skip that.
games, folks. But with that, because I had just played the new Silent Hill last year, I thought I would return to the location that was the influence for Silent Hill, and that's Centralia, Pennsylvania, which I
I've
have
been to,
driven
by the
through.
way. I've
Yeah,
gone.
I've been
I've
there a
walked
bunch
around,
too.
yeah.
Yeah, it's wild. So when I used to drive from my parents' house in Virginia up to New York City when I was living there, Centralia is just like it's an exit off of the interstate when you're driving up through there. And so I had stopped a couple of times and walked around, and apparently it's changed quite a bit, but I just thought I would talk a little bit about the history of Centralia and specifically where the influence into Silent Hill came in. So Centralia was a coal mining town. And in 1962, one of the coal seams caught fire. And there were a lot of theories about how it caught fire. Some people said that it was this mine explosion from the 1930s that never burned out completely. Some people said that it was like a bootlegging mining operation, that they were being really careless. But most people agree that somebody was burning trash in an old strip mine and that it caught an exposed seam of coal on fire. And thus the entire town started burning from underneath. This is back in 1962. Nobody notices anything. They're just like, yeah, whatever. It's burning underneath, it's underground, whatevs. Until the late 70s, early 1980s. So, like 10, 15 years pass. All of a sudden, 1980s roll around. All of a sudden, all these toxic gases start coming up from the earth. There's wafts of smoke everywhere. The town just looks smoky. People start getting really sick. And then it starts getting really bad by the end of the 1980s. So at that point, people weren't moving yet. They were just kind of like, oh, yeah, we should do something about this. It smells like sulfur in our town now. By the end of the 1980s, the ground is so hot that it's melting roads. They're having problems with gas tanks because they're getting too hot and exploding. It's causing sinkholes all over the town. And so a lot of money is spent trying to keep it from burning. They spend a ton of money trying to put it out underground, but nothing ever works. And so by the 1980s, the government starts stepping in and paying to relocate people. But some people absolutely refused to go because, one, they didn't like what the government was paying them. But a lot of people also thought that it was a hoax so that the government could eminent domain their properties and take all the coal that's underneath it. And this is still a thing today. There are still people who live in Centralia and refuse to go because of this massive amount of distrust. And there are people who still swear that there's hundreds of million dollars worth of coal under the town and that the government's just waiting for everybody else to move so that they can get in there.
Well, as somebody who screened Descent again yesterday for a class, that would be my Descent pitch. We're going to go in, find the goal. And so it's just like Descent, but the things are actually on fire and there's
It's
smoke in every shot.
burning
That
while
would be
we're
an
doing it.
amazing. So they're like fire guys with
Yeah.
fire retarded suits and stuff. That'd be cool.
There's creatures who have survived under there for
Well, now they're all, they'd be all
like
messed
all
up.
fucked up, but they've survived the heat and they're coming for you. So all the bootleg mining operations. I went through it 10 years ago when I still lived in New York City. And at the time, it was an abandoned town. Like you could still see houses. There were still townhouses. There were still farmhouses. There was a church. And so you're not supposed to be walking around there. So this is all illegal, but you could like park your car and walk around and see the abandoned town. And yes, it smelled very much like sulfur. And yes, there were just wafts of smoke coming through the air, and you could see where the road had like buckled under the heat and stuff like that. And there was also this big long stretch of highway that I looked it up, and they called it Graffiti Highway. It was just a big long stretch of road where it had literally buckled in the middle. It split down the middle, and people had drawn all over it with graffiti. Apparently, somewhere in the last 10 years, the government went in and tore down all the buildings to try to keep people like you and me from being like, let's go see that shit. So they went in and they tore down everything except for the church. So supposedly the only things that are still standing there are houses that people are still living in, because people are still living there, and the church. And so there's not, and apparently they also covered over that graffiti highway with dirt and put like big old speed bumps in, so you can't even like bike down it or anything like that anymore. And there were warning signs all over the place when I was there 10 years ago about toxic gases and the ground collapsing. And apparently they put even more of that. But apparently there was a lot of dark tourists. It was very easy to get into. That's the biggest thing that I remember, is I literally pulled my car off the interstate, pulled over at a sign that said Centralia and had like the population, and then I walked. And
Yeah, I
it
think we
was
drove. I
very
went in 97, 98 and took black and white photos. I've got a ton of photos. I still have them somewhere of the just the smoke coming up through the cracks and like cool things like that. And it was, before I wouldn't have even known what Silent Hill is back then. And I just thought it was the coolest idea for a place to do something, you know?
Oh, yeah. So when you look at Silent Hill, that's kind of where the original conceit came out of, was this completely abandoned shell of a town, the wafting smoke, the burning underneath. It's just all kind of present. And what I found out researching at this time, it will take 250 years for that shit to burn out completely.
Wow.
So got a
That's
long
crazy.
time to go there. So yeah,
That's a lot of
burn on,
podcasts.
Centralia. Yeah. It's, and apparently it also influenced a Dean Koontz book called Strange Highways that I now have to
Oh,
look up.
yeah, I'd look that up. Okay, well, now we are going to have on our guest, who, speaking of, he would actually write a great book about Centralia, to
I'm
be
sure he
honest.
would.
It would tie in very nice. An author who I discovered many years ago, but we both really loved his book last year, The October Film Haunt. We are about to talk to Michael Wehunt. Okay, we are very thrilled to welcome the show somebody whose short films, short stories rather, not films, but in my brain they were films as I wrote to him like, I don't know, like 8 years ago maybe. Michael Wehunt is joining us from Georgia. He, a writer of the collection Greener Pastures, which I was a huge fan of early on, and the October Film Haunt last year, which was a great book, and the Ark that came to our house yesterday, Nightjar is coming up.
Yeah, just got it. I'm so excited to jump in. This one looks so good. But we've been wanting to have you on for a long time, so welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so.
Yay. So let's start with kind of your first short story book, which I know Elric had talked about. Oh God, we've been podcasting forever. It's been a long time
Never
since,
came out.
you had
And I
talked
don't,
about
and
that
I'm not
one.
somebody who was reading a lot of horror at that time, and I was like, I just was, a little turned off by certain things, and I don't know why I even picked it up in the first place, which is funny, but there was a lot of stories in there, kind of organic nature. There was things about it that kind of got, it gets under your skin, and I did wonder, because you're writing in Georgia, and how your location, how you write with your location, I guess, is part of the question in regards to that book of short stories especially.
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to just the fact that Georgia has a lot of trees. There's woods everywhere. You go up north and you're where I grew up, like not too far from Tennessee and North Carolina. You get into the Appalachians, it's kind of where they begin. It's where the Appalachian Trail starts, or ends if you look at it from the other side. But there, I kind of grew up around the mountains, the forest everywhere, although we call them woods because we're a little simpler. And I just played in the woods a lot. I always kind of revered the woods without being aware that that's what I was doing. And I definitely carried that into adulthood with me. And when I read or even listen to music, I really think it seeps into everything about the way I process the world. And I've always been a big nature person. I like hiking, but I'm not a big hiker. I am not a rock climber or anything like that, but I do revere nature, and I kind of feel like it's like a cathedral or a church. So, and you read a lot of older horror fiction in particular and weird fiction, and nature and the very best of that fiction can kind of become a character in and of itself. And that was always, I just inherently thought of it that way already. So when I started writing, I just, nature always felt like it needed to be very, very present, very alive. And, like earthy language is something I've always been drawn to, and that fits right into nature. And just without really planning to, I just always brought it into what I was doing. And even Atlanta, just not a huge city, but it's one of the bigger cities. There are lots and lots of trees here. It's like one of the most dense green spaces of any major cities. And it's just around my house, there's just so much wooded area. And so it's always been with me.
I like that you say you revere it more than, because in those books, it's more like you say, weird tales, the book, the stories you'd read in weird tales, or more Lovecraftian in the sense of you're almost on the side of nature. You're not making it other and evil, even though it might seem sinister in some of the stories. It never really felt like that to me. It always felt like a very objective look at nature, weirdly enough, which I thought was like, maybe that's why it felt so original.
So wait, did you ever thru hike on the AT since you're in the area?
I've been on the AT several times, but I've definitely never,
Thru hiked it.
I've never made a serious endeavor of it. And I like the idea of it, but I don't know if I will. I'm not going to make a promise here that I won't keep.
The longest I've ever made it was 4 days, and at 4 days, it was, and we went all the most of the way up Virginia. But I really, and we weren't supposed to get off for like another. It was supposed to be a 7 day hike, and I got off at four because I realized that's my max before I have to have a shower. I have to really brush my teeth, like in front of a sink, not standing over a puddle on the floor. Like that was the point where I was reaching my kind of like woodsy insanity breaking point. Which I'm now fascinated by, like how long it takes for people to get to that point. Like, is it a couple of hours? Is it a couple of days? So yeah, I think there is a point where most of us are just kind of like, I have to go back home now. So, but yeah. So incorporating that into Greener Pastures, like, can, because I have not read this one. I know Elric's a huge fan. How did you kind of weave nature into it as you're crafting these short stories? Was that kind of always the conceit, or did you have a bunch of short stories and then realize that that was the connective tissue between all of them?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the latter. Because writing short stories, now that I've written a couple of novels, I'm able to understand that writing short stories is very different. And I like to start from an image or a what if thought, or it's usually pretty basic, and I just want to explore it and see why it's bugging me. And not all my stories take place outside. I definitely don't want to give that impression, but they tend to end up outside in some way. And I just, like Elric said, the woods can seem menacing even if they're not. They can seem benevolent even if they're not. The reality is they don't care about you, and you're just a small creature inside of them. So it rarely is it super deliberate, but like I'll set a story in a mountain cabin. I'll set a story in, other locales that force me into the woods. And so that's very deliberate. But I didn't really plan a connective tissue. Just like a lot of people really focus on the fact that the stories in Greener Pastures were heavily dealing with loss and grief, that even that wasn't really on purpose. It's just something that fascinates me and something I very obviously carry around with me. Maybe I need to like go speak to a professional about why I write about it so much, but
If you do that, you will stop writing about it. That's why David
Yeah.
Lynch didn't go to one. He goes, I went to one time and realized that I would lose all my creativity if I kept going, so he stopped. But I'm curious because one of the stories in that was the one I remember writing to you about where when I read it, because it's quite different, totally different, I would say, than what became October Film Haunt. But there was the same kind of title or the same idea of people going into a space who make videos online to kind of expose or deepen, you know, online myths and urban legends and stuff. How much, like, because it is completely different. For some reason, I must have thought when you said you're writing a novel with that, I'm like, oh, it's probably going to be that story fleshed out, but it is almost unrelated. So maybe talk about those connections and how you got to October Film Haunt in general.
Yeah, well, the original story, which is called October Film Haunt Under the House, because Under the House is the name of the movie that it concerns, that started in the woods, and that was, me going into the woods again. But the origin of that is I really just wanted to write a found footage story and pay homage to that subgenre, which is very dear to me. And I find that most, and I kind of took this approach with the novel too. I find that most found footage stories are about a film crew or professionals in some sense, whereas the people who are devouring the content are horror fans. And I wanted to write a story from the perspective of horror fans who aren't filmmakers and don't have any technical know-how. And so that's where the thought of that came out of my head. So it's like just a kind of a round robin journal based story from these friends and this horror film group who go seek out the filming locations of cult horror movies. And Under the House happens to be an extra mysterious one. Almost nothing's known about anybody who made it. And so they think they're the first to find out where it was filmed using a clue, a very subtle clue that's in the movie. So I just wanted to have a few guys go to a location, pay homage to the beloved horror genre, and then just have everything go absolutely crazy. So.
Yeah, well, I'd recommend when people read October Film Haunt, the novel, they should go back to read that short story because it is its own wild ride. And I think what got me excited is the way nature's used in it. And it's, I won't ruin it for people, but I hadn't quite ever read a or seen a found footage film quite like that. And that's what I loved about it. It's so interesting. So with the novel, you know, which I know Becca was a huge fan of as well last year, let's talk about found footage then, your beloved found footage and the inspiration for this being your first novel. Obviously, there's a lot of pressure, self-imposed probably, about getting a first novel out.
Yeah, again, going back to the short story, because there basically a lot of people over the years were like, I wish this was a novel. So obviously that seed was planted. And when the time came to write a novel, I just couldn't get it out of my head. And I had revisited that world once in another short story, but I had never really explored it in any deep way. So I started making these connections and thinking of ways that I could expand it. And I didn't want to just take the original story and expand it into a novel size story. I wanted it to be something that would kind of take the story into itself, but be entirely separate. I wanted a separate movie for the novel to revolve around. And my main axle for the novel was the thought that, again, most found footage horror movies, the protagonists are the film crew, the person with the camera, and to whatever degree, whatever the context might be, it's the person holding the camera is the person you're rooting for and the person you're hoping gets away alive and all that. But I was thinking, what if the people making the movie were the villains? And that really interested me because you bring in issues like invasion of privacy and stalking and home invasion and really frightening things. And when I thought about that, everything started to kind of lock into place for me and I could move forward with it. And it just really fascinated me because if you were in a movie but you didn't want to be in the movie, like that's really frightening, and I that scared me, so I wanted to explore it. And
Well, people holding up cameras to people on the streets, that content that you see all the time now, I hate that. If somebody does that to me, I will punch the camera, and I'm not even joking. It happened to be one time, like on a ship when I was, on a trip, and I was just like, "What are you doing? Like, stop! Like, it's so invasive." And so the idea, so take that to 1,000. If somebody's making an actual movie and filming outside your house at night, and it's very unsettling. I agree.
Were there any particular real kind of sub movies, like underground movies, that you were looking at for kind of when you were creating the cult fandom that exists around the October film Haunt? When you were looking at like the level of the fandom in that?
I mean, that's a good question, and I have been asked it before. I mean, the obvious ones for me were The Ring, because The Ring kind of takes the media format and makes it a horror object. And that's that, although the October Film Haunt deals with content online for the most part, there is the footage does take on an occult power when the viewer participates in the viewing, I wanted to make the people watching the movie participants in the ritual, so to speak. I'm trying to summon to actually summon something. And The Ring has an element of that, albeit in a different way. You're passing on a virus of sorts by engaging with the material. I also really wanted it to be a slasher movie, and the Scream series always meant a lot to me. like Sidney Prescott, there's pretty much all the, especially the older movies, they're my comfort food. I turn to them when I need comforting. Then, there are things like, I'm blanking on the name of the movie.
That's okay.
But
No
you can explain
worries.
it.
You can always
Explain it.
explain it. We're here for you.
It's a by a Japanese filmmaker. It's about a kind of a reality TV show. He made a movie named a called A Cult.
Ooh, okay.
I can't think of the name of this movie. Oh,
Now, is it not
it's
incantation?
no, it's older than that. I really wish I'd looked it up
That's
beforehand.
okay.
That's right. People are yelling at their podcast right now. They know
Podcast.
the name.
That's the
The kind of
beautiful
people who
thing
listen to the
about
show,
the
somebody
show.
will know. Yeah.
Yeah, somebody is screaming and is about to DM us on Instagram with the answer.
Just
So it's all good. We'll get it eventually.
how those guys. Are you somebody who is more influenced when you're younger in terms of the horror, by the horror films or by horror literature? Have you swung more one way when you're getting into horror?
It started with movies for me, but I was reading Stephen King by the time I was 9, even though maybe I shouldn't have. But so for a long time, I thought horror was Stephen King. Like I, grew up in a small town, and we didn't have much money, and all I had was the library, and that was it. So it was definitely movies, because they would actually come on TV sometimes, and I would be allowed to watch them for some reason. My mom always says I never had nightmares, so she thought it was okay if I watched them. So,
Which is kind of the barometer. I mean,
yeah.
I did have nightmares, and they still somehow let me watch them,
Nah.
and that was the difference. But with my own kids, it's like no, I it's I they can start watching them when they want, as long as I don't have to deal with the consequences.
Yeah,
Because
my kids never had nightmares. They did, but they were never about the movies. It was always like stupid stuff. And so I've never stopped them from watching any of the stuff that I'm watching unless it's highly sexual. That's the only thing I kind of draw the line at. But yeah. But yeah, the screams, they do flow in the household. But with that, kind of, can you tell us a little bit about Nightjars? What's it about? Are we again looking at kind of trauma themes, outdoor themes, and kind of what you're creating? Creation process was on it.
Yeah, it is. A lot of it takes place outdoors, which I guess that's something that I'm going to have to analyze now. But
Nightjar, it's a bird, right? It's a type of
yes.
bird. Yeah.
Yeah, and
Spoiler, guys. Sorry.
I don't think that's a spoiler.
It's a
I think
bird.
it's a well-known
It's
bird.
on the cover.
Okay, there you go.
And to be honest, and this is the tiniest spoiler, like book really doesn't have anything to do with the birds, although the concept of the birds heavily influenced the story. So they do and they don't have a lot of involvement in the story. You just won't really see them on the page and in the words themselves.
But good title. I like a good title like that, where it's a little not quite connected. It's good.
Well, my first thought about the second novel was that it couldn't have anything to do with movies, which made me very sad. I would probably write books about found footage, online footage, horror movies in some way, every book for the rest of my life if I could get away with it. But that wasn't going to be allowed. So I just,
Just write a script then in between. Write a good found footage script in between.
it's hard enough. I'm trying to write a novel a year, basically. I'm gonna see if that's possible for me to sustain, and that all my time goes into that. But when I think of some future with increased bandwidth, I love to think about things like that. Yeah, there's definitely heavy trauma in this book. It involves a man who had a very traumatic and dark childhood, to the point where he has addiction issues, and he's actually repressed a lot of the memories from when he was a child, which is too bad because he comes to a place where he has to try to remember those memories. This is really my first time talking about the book, so
Okay, yeah, it's early, yeah.
pardon me if I am trying to like redirect myself away from spoilers.
Yeah. No, we don't want to spoil it for ourselves either, because it's sitting on it. But the basic, yeah, what the basic setup would be without the hook, I guess.
The main character's Luke. He had a terrible childhood, like I said, a lot of repressed memories that he's pretty successfully managed to bury and keep away from him. He's tried therapy in the past, like hypnotherapy, and he was extremely susceptible to it, and it was very effective for him, but he just got scared away from it. But his problems did get worse and worse until his wife left him and took their very young daughter with her. And so now his daughter's 4 years old. He's trying to rebuild his life so that he can see her as much as he can. He bought a bookstore a little under a year ago, and just things are going pretty well. And then he's on almost a blind date with a woman at a restaurant one night, and this is all on the jacket copy. I'm not giving anything away. She gets up to go to the restroom and never comes back. And he's waiting and waiting and starting to get really anxious and wanting to drink her alcoholic drink that was on the table, but trying to not let himself. Then the waiter comes and kind of jostles her napkin, and he sees something under it, and he pulls it out, and it's an old Polaroid photograph that has him as a little boy in it.
Oh,
And
darn. No, no more. No more. That's
yeah, you
it.
stop
That's your
there.
hook.
That's
I
your
mean,
hook.
you
You're
had me at
done.
she didn't come back from the bathroom, because I love, like, there's some TV movies from the 70s and stuff that have kind of hooks like that, and I always just, but adding the Polaroid, I'm in. I'm
That's
good.
all you need, is she's connected to him somehow, and we're done. So yeah, that
Well, you
sounds epic.
and you mentioned, and we wrote you asking for a few films to and only ask that beyond being interested, but also, like, I think sometimes that's a good hook for people to want to read a book, is understanding the
Especially.
kind of movies that were on your mind and things like that, just because of how this is a film podcast for the most part. So
Especially because one of the ones that you put on your list was Dracula, and what you just described sounds very unvampiric. So I'm intrigued by kind of where those other ones fit
and you
in.
don't have to explain the connection if there's
You can
spoilers, but
just
just
drop the films.
tell us the few films that were on your mind.
Yeah, well, the jacket copy, which anybody can find online now, so it's official and it's out there. The jacket copy starts with the line, "Memento meets Dracula." So
Interesting. Okay.
we put it right in there.
Yeah.
and then kind of I kind of think of it as burying the lead by putting it right up front, which is, kind of backward and counterintuitive, but that's kind of what we did because the rest of the jacket copy doesn't really expound upon why the name Dracula's in there.
Well, you already got my
So
attention because I'm obsessed with amnesia movies. It's my favorite. Like, if I ever wrote a book, it'll be on amnesia and films because I wrote a list like 10 years when Letterboxd first started of every movie that has an element of amnesia because it's also very fake. Like, it's the most cinematic device. You get hit on the head, you wake up. Oh, I can't remember who I am. There's so many movies, but I always think it's because it works so well as a mystery tool to like slowly unpeel ourselves. It's like so interesting.
And I understand how much it's used as a device, but I do think that there is something to like not remembering moments around things. Like I was in a car wreck when I was 16 and I still can't remember anything except for waking up with the deer halfway through the hood. I can't remember the actual impact or anything like that. So I do think that there is something fascinating to kind of why you block those things out.
But
And
losing
it's always,
consciousness, you actually do lose. You do lose all that immediate memory. Like, I've been knocked out playing rugby in New Zealand before and wake up and it's like 20 minutes later and you're like, wait, what just happened? You have no, there's no, nothing there. But like the whole losing your actual identity, like, not saying that's what your one
those
is.
are the ones. No,
That's what I
mine's
find
literally
so
like I
fascinating,
couldn't tell you what the deer running towards the car looked like. I can only tell you what the aftermath was. And I didn't
Well,
even hit
neither
my
can the
head.
deer.
Yeah, no, the deer did
The
not make
deer's
it.
done. All right.
That was a really bad one. But I think that there is something fascinating about those moments in our life where time seems to slow down and you can remember very specifically certain things, but you lose others in the process. We should do a whole episode on amnesia movies at some point, I
Yeah,
feel
there's
like.
lots. I mean, obviously, film noir, that was a big device in the noir period.
But
But, like,
that is a
so is
good
that
one.
an element of this is about repressed memory?
Yeah, there are the memories from the past that are highly relevant, and he has to almost solve the mystery of them. But there are also moments where there are gaps in the timeline of the actual story itself where he can't remember what happened the night before.
Oh, cool.
And then that's where the photographs I started to talk about earlier come into play.
Cool.
Because you get a photograph saying, hey, you did this thing. And you're like, well, I have no memory of that. Well, it was just 2 days ago. Like, that didn't happen. That's kind of where the story gear turns.
So we've got Memento and Dracula, three more. Not letting you off the hook like that. That's too.
You got
That's on
three
the
more
dust
films to
jacket.
go.
Well, just to push it a little further,
Yeah.
I would actually bring in 30 Days of Night.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Not to use, because that's actually a far more relevant comparison than Dracula would be. And again, I don't want to really dig into why I'm
Yeah.
bringing that movie up. I just
You don't
want to
have to.
throw that out there. And I would also say Cachet by Michael Haneke.
Ooh.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, yeah.
Is that how his last name's actually pronounced?
You'll hear it. I've said Haneke my whole
I've
life,
said Haneke
but none of
forever,
us are
but I don't
Austrian, so
think
what do we
that's
know?
right. No.
In Austria, it's probably
Yes.
Henk.
Oh, well, that's just tantalizing like crazy now, because that is all about kind of like repressing childhood memories and losing something.
And
Yeah.
I'm just really into the, it's not even a major element of the movie, I would say, but the idea of seeing yourself in a context you shouldn't exist in, you're shown as
Right.
something you are not, but this tangible, permanent image is telling you something about yourself that you don't believe, and what do you do with that? And I like, I'll use, might be mispronouncing it again, but Haneke, I like him a lot because Funny Games was actually pretty big influence on the October Film Hunt, and that one moment where the fourth wall breaks just really, really had an impact on me, and I wanted to bring that into the October Film Hunt a little. So that's three.
Four, technically, because you did Dracula and
Okay.
me too. Yeah, and 30 Days a Night, yeah. So you got one more.
So you did write them to us in an email.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless it's a spoiler. If something spoils too much of it, you can also.
Yeah, then we can just stick with four.
I would use Strange Harvest, partly because it's a movie I saw recently.
I loved that one. That hit a lot of sweet spots for me.
And I really, even though I wrote the book before I saw the movie, I still really connected with the true crime, homicide detective element of that, and it felt like it influenced Nightjars, even though I wrote Nightjars first. But
Nice.
it's kind of like when I saw the TV series The Leftovers, I felt like it had influenced me before I even watched the first episode. It was kind of this weird, like almost spiritual connection I felt.
That's what our taste, I think, can do as creators. Like, there'll be a movie you saw young when you're young, and you almost feel like you were part of that movie. Like, you made that movie, or it imprinted so much that you need to make that movie. It's the thing you're kind of chasing in weird ways sometimes.
And
Yeah.
a bonus one, I would say Kill List by Ben Wheatley.
Oh,
Just
that's one of Elric's
because
faves.
I really admire how that movie
Yeah.
starts off as one thing and then kind of switches subgenres in the middle, and you realize it's actually about this whole other thing. Again, I'm not gonna expound upon that because I would get into spoiler territory.
Now, since we've got Nightjars coming out early fall, you said that you're trying to do one a year. Are you deep in another one right now? Oh, fantastic. Can we get one word? Doesn't need to be a spoiler, just one word.
Well, I have to do two. I'll say haunted house.
Oh, okay. I love
Love
it. That's such good variation from from all the different books.
a haunted
Yeah,
house.
there are certain books that there's no way I'm not gonna write my take on it, and haunted house is definitely one of those. So if I don't do
Yeah, it's a favorite. What's the name of the short? I forgive me for not remembering, but I think it's an Inconsolable collection. What's the name of the short story where the person's at the computer getting the messages from the one that's kind of similar in a similar world
The
as
Pine Arch
Trevor Noah?
Collection.
Pine Arch Collection. I only want to bring it up because I want people to point people to it. I think that's the creepiest thing you've written. I think all three of them have creepy elements, but that one probably unnerved me the most as I was reading it, because there's just something about something slowly coming towards me, a feeling of something, the walls closing in. So if somebody wants to read the, I would recommend the October Film Haunt story in Greener Pastures, October Film Haunt, and that as kind of key text to read to get started with your work.
Yeah, the Pine Arch Collection is available for free online. You
Oh, cool.
just go to my website, look at the bibliography page. You'll see it. You'll see you read for free, and it'll take you to where it is.
Probably a creepier way to
Awesome.
read it, actually,
Yeah.
online. Yeah.
And we've got Nightjars is coming out early September, is that right?
Late September.
Late September. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Michael. It has been awesome finally getting to chat with you about everything, and please keep us posted about the Haunted House film coming soon.
I will.
Okay, so let's jump into our final rec of the night. Elric, you want to give us yours first?
Yeah, mine's real quick because it's a novella and I'm halfway through it. So I can't, but it's called The Blue World. A friend of mine recommended it to me. It is in an anthology of like 13 stories by the novelist from the 80s and 90s, Robert R. McCammon, who I
Oh,
haven't.
God, I've read a bunch of his
Yeah,
stuff.
see, I haven't, and a friend of mine's into his stuff a lot, but it's a bunch of short stories, but then it ends with a novella that was also released by itself called The Blue World. And it's just such a good idea for a movie. It is a Catholic priest. No, it opens with a San Francisco, a sex club stripper is brutally murdered because this guy's obsessed and thinks he's her boyfriend kind of thing, and he's dressed like a cowboy and is like a red tear tattooed on his eye, and he's just a mysterious figure basically, and he kills her because he was kind of obsessed by her. And then that's the cold open. And then you hear these Catholic priests talking about it down the street, and there's this young innocent priest and he has who has never been part of that world, and he's sitting in his confessional, and a friend of hers comes in to the confessional to talk about, the death of her friend, and he's just turned on by her voice, by he can't see her face, but her perfume, and he's like never been turned on before, never thought of woman, and he can't help it, and now he's obsessed by her. Like he when she walks out, he's watching, he's like, oh my God, why am I feeling this way? He goes down the street, goes into a porn store, and finds one of her VHS because she's a porn star. So he looks up Deborah Rocks and rents one of her films, and then goes home, and he's like, knows he's gonna get in trouble if he's found out. He doesn't know why he's doing it, and he watches and he feels bad about it. And so it's basically this character who's like starting to kind of obsess, but he hasn't met her. Meanwhile, that killer she is the next target. So the serial killer killing woman in the sex industry, she's going to be the next target. Lo and behold, the priest follows her home one day from something and basically bumps into her in a supermarket. But he's like, still very innocent. He doesn't know what he wants. He's just kind of obsessed with the feeling he's feeling. And she sees him as like a lucky person and his freshness. He doesn't say he's a priest. He lies about being a priest. And then she kind of likes him and she's kind of into him. And now there's a budding romance between a priest and a porn star while a serial killer is hunting her and now seeing this guy as a threat. And that's where I am in the story. I don't know how it's going to wrap up, but it's really fun and really over the top. And I'm like, oh, that's a good hook. So anyway, The Blue World, and I have to read more stuff now by Robert R. McKim. I think somebody said he's mostly does supernatural stuff, so this is different. This story is definitely different.
I have a bunch of his old paperbacks because they all have
Very
really cool
paperbacky,
covers.
yeah.
I have not jumped into a lot of them. Okay, for my final rec of the night, because I know you're a fan of this one, I did Mask of the Red Death,
Oh yeah.
which I had never seen before. I've seen all the other Poe Corman cycle movies, but I had never seen
My
this
fave.
one. I just knew the imagery from it. 1964. This is directed by Roger Corman and, of course, starring Vincent Price. And I wasn't even sure exactly what one of the Poe stories this is following, but the one that it was Red Death. But the one that I really also pulled out is it's got this great subplot, which is Hop Frog, which is one of my favorite Poe stories about this court jester who gets kicked around a lot and goes pretty much ballistic and like decides to strike back at the court and kill them all. And it's in here. That's a huge part of this. So it is Vincent Price. He is this very corrupt, very pompous prince who oversees the land. He is driving through one day with the peasants and starts punishing them, starts torturing some of the peasants, saying he's going to kill some of them, and just kind of being an absolute dick. And he hears this screaming while he's there in the peasant lands. And he goes into one of the shacks to see what the screaming is. And it is a woman whose face is covered in blood. And he's like, oh my God, the plague is here. It's the Red Death. And that's now what we understand as the plague. He gathers up all of his other courtsmen. They rush back to the courts, to his castle. And they say, we're locking down the castle. The plague is here. It's affecting all the peasants. Nobody can get in. And he kidnaps one of the peasant girls that he thinks is hot and takes with him. And so they have locked it down. Now, all the peasants are going to be coming and being like, oh my God, we're being infected by plague. We need food. We're all starving. There's plague here. And he's like, get the fuck off my property. And then he starts firing arrows at them. Real asshole. In the meantime, we discovered that the peasants all worshiped God, that they're all very pious people. But in the court, Vincent Price has led them all down a path of Satan, and they've all become Satan worshipers. Well, he decides to have a party one night, and this mysterious figure cloaked in red shows up, and he's all like, Satan, my buddy, I've been meaning to hang out with you. But we then find out it is Red Death himself that has come to the party to infect the whole court. And then lunacy ensues. This is a weird, surrealistic, wild movie. With, it's not satanic as much as it is just kind of hyper psychotropic.
Yeah,
Is
it's
the only
probably
way I
more
can put
like
it.
your vices, letting all the vices fly, and but it's
Yeah.
also one of the most I mean, it's the most artistic thing I think Corman ever did. It's
So
shot by
colorful.
Nicholas Roeg. It's beautiful. It's getting remade this year by Charlie Pollinger, the guy who made The Plague at the end of last year with Mikey Madison and Léa Seydoux. And so it's gender flipping. The bad guys are going to be these women running courts or whatever, however it's going to. So
Oh,
should
nice.
be it could be interesting.
Yeah, no, this was a treat. And considering, how much I've loved Tomb of Ligeia and things like that, it was great. But anyways, thank you all for listening so much. Thank you all for the support on our deep cuts. Please check it out. And we will be back in 2 weeks with another fun show. Thank you.